Chapter 15, How Our Bodies Emit Light. All of us emit light, as do all living things. But it is a kind of light that cannot easily be detected. Since particles of light are called photons, which is a word coined for them in 1916 by the physicist Leonard Thomson Trolland, those spontaneously emitted by living tissues have come to be called biophotons. Biophoton emission is not the same as bioluminescence, which is what we see with fireflies, electric fish, and a few other creatures. It is also not the same as chemiluminescence, light emitted by a chemical reaction, which can also sometimes be seen taking place in living things. All those emissions of light can be seen by the eye, but biophotons cannot. Biophotons are emitted when electrons in the organism get energized or what's called excited. They are therefore useful for detection and diagnosis, and as indicators of what is happening in the organism. Biophotons are so faint that they are what is known as ultra-weak emissions of light. If something is ultra-weak, then surely you might say it is of no importance. But nothing could be further from the truth. We have good reason to believe that biophotons are fundamental to our existence. And when the emission of biophotons by our bodies goes wrong, it means that we have a serious illness. It is now known, for example, that changes in biophoton emission rates are the earliest possible sign of cancer. So early is their warning that millions of lives could be saved or significantly extended if a mass biophoton detection program were adopted. With such extremely early warnings, incipient tumors could be removed before they became dangerous, when they were still only a few cells in size. Such tiny incipient tumors can easily be zapped and destroyed by ablations using keyhole surgery. Biophoton detection is not invasive and does not require expensive scanners. It does not bombard the body with radiation. It is an entirely passive process. It need cost very little. Indeed, it can be done by a simple blood test. At the present time, only one machine exists in the world for taking these images. Biophoton research is barely funded and is ignored by all the world's governments except the Dutch, which is strange, considering that cancer prevention at an early stage could save such gigantic sums of public and private money in treating cancers. In fact, the world's medical insurance companies should sponsor mass biophoton detection to increase their business profits enormously. For a large-scale biophoton scan of, say, half of the body, the person needs to sit in complete darkness for at least half an hour in order for residual light effects to dissipate. After that, it takes some considerable time to wait for the ultra-weak emissions to register. And in images which can be seen, taken in total darkness, with spontaneously emitted biophotons as the only light source for the image, one can see quite spooky images of people, and one of the strange features of the head is that you get two dark holes where the eyes are. Don't know why that is. There is another way to detect biophotons by means of a portable detector with two long empty gloves hanging from the front. A person inserts his or her arms into the gloves, which reach to the elbow. The hands, being entirely in the dark inside the small machine, then have their spontaneously emitted biophotons counted by the machine's twin photomultiplier detectors. Just from counting the biophotons coming from the hands, it is possible to know whether a cancer condition is developing somewhere in the human body. A positive finding then suggests that more tests should be carried out to locate it. A negative finding suggests that they are probably unnecessary and there is no cancer condition. The main basis for this is that changes in ultra-weak photon emission occur in the transition from a healthy to a diseased state. And this is the earliest warning signal. Biophoton research, despite all its promise, has been shrinking, not expanding. There is little or no funding for it. Public health officials are too dim to see its potential, and it is outside their comfort zone. Big Pharma is never going to promote it, and most doctors don't know about it. The heyday of biophoton research was in the 1990s, when many publications on the subject appeared. But at that stage, the detectors which I have mentioned did not yet exist. So all that was written was based upon laboratory research, and the equipment was not yet in existence for public use. The big-name researchers in the field at that time have mostly died or retired by now, and have not been replaced. One can go down the list of names prominent then, and one soon discovers that only a few are still alive, and several of those have become inactive because they could not find anyone to fund their work. The combined knowledge of several brilliant scientists from many countries is in danger of being lost to humanity through ignorance and prejudice. And the price of this ignorance and prejudice is that many, many people will die needlessly. The leading proponent and researcher of biophoton technology for human health today is probably the Dutch scientist Professor Roland van Wyk. Although he is now retired, his son Dr. Edward van Wyk leads a group at Leiden University in the Netherlands, to which his father is a leading scientific advisor. They are actively researching biophotons and are apparently the only group in the whole of Europe doing so. Roland did important work earlier with another such group in Japan, headed by Masaki Kobayashi of Tohoku Technical University at Sendai. In 2014, van Wyk, and that's W-I-J-K, published a mammoth book on biophotons in biology and medicine, which is extraordinarily clear and explanatory. It can easily be read by any medical doctor or person with some basic education in biology. It is described as an interdisciplinary textbook, and the hope is that some academics somewhere will actually use it as such. In any case, the book exists, and van Wyk has done the public a great service. However, the number of copies available is now very small, so that the book is not achieving the wide circulation it urgently needs. Biophotons were first discovered in plants by a brilliant Russian scientist, Professor Alexander Gurvich, 1874 to 1954. There were various spellings for Gurvich. The correct Russian spelling ends in V-I-C-H, but the German ending is the more commonly used, which is W-I-T-S-C-H. While studying the growth of onion roots in 1923, Gurvich was able to demonstrate the existence of biophotons, though he did not call them by that name. Gurvich's theory was that organisms grew in connection with fields of some kind, which he named morphogenetic fields. He was the first person in history to use the term field in connection with biology. In a paper concerning the growth and development of embryos, which he commenced writing in 1911 and published in 1912. But at that stage of his work, he had no proof, only a theory. It was only in 1923 that he was able to demonstrate physical evidence for his theory. He had already concluded that cell division, known in biological terminology as mitosis, in embryos must require not one, but two factors. The first was a possibility factor, meaning that the circumstances must become such that cell division was rendered possible. The second was a realization factor, meaning that the cell division, having become possible, was then somehow triggered. Without this trigger, it simply would not take place. He did not believe that this trigger was chemical. Instead, Gurvich decided that the way the organism as a whole triggered cell division for its embryonic cells to divide and grow, must take the form of external, non-chemical signals of some kind. But what could they be? And how could the signals be detected by the cells? He decided that each cell membrane must be, quote, an organ perceiving signals for cell divisions, unquote. That's what he thought each cell membrane was. Gurvitch became the first person in the history of biology to use the term receptor. He suspected that the cell membranes must contain receptors of some kind to detect signals of some kind to cause cell division, which he called mitotic signals. Remember that mitosis is the technical word for cell division, hence mitotic signals. Gurvitch then carried out his now famous onion experiment, studying the growing tips of onion roots. The roots had to be as even and smooth as possible and were placed at right angles to each other so that the tip of one root was directed precisely at the zone of the other where a cell division would take place. He found that the tip of one onion root, which he called the inducer, when directed at the wall of the other onion root, which he called the detector, induced more cell divisions on the side of the detector root that faced the inducer root than it did on the shadow side. This led him to believe that some kind of signals, which he called external impulses, were being sent, affecting the near side much more than the opposite side. It was as if the near side was in the light and the far side was in the shade. Then he had the extraordinary idea of inserting first a glass plate and later a transparent quartz plate between the two roots. He discovered that the glass plate blocked the signals, so that no cell division took place in the detector root, but the quartz plate did not block the signals. This unexpected and bizarre finding ruled out chemical or mechanical signals, since the signals were not blocked by quartz. It quickly became apparent to Gurvitch that the mystery could be solved only by postulating that the inducer roots were emitting photons in the ultraviolet range, and that those were the signals in play. As most people know, UV radiation from the sun does not penetrate glass windows, which is why we do not get sunburn indoors, even if we are sitting under a glass roof in the blazing sun. But ultraviolet radiation does penetrate quartz. Gurvitch called the ultraviolet signals mitogenetic rays because they were rays causing cell division, in other words, mitosis. As I mentioned earlier, the word photon for light particles had only been coined in physics 7 years earlier, in 1916, and it was not yet in common use, so the idea of calling his rays biophotons did not occur to Gurvitch. It was the German professor, Fritz Albert Popp, P-O-P-P, who introduced the term biophotons in the 1970s to replace the terminology mitogenetic rays. A fascinating account of the history of Gurvitch's work and discoveries was published in English in 2007 by his grandson, Professor Lev Belousov, jointly with his colleague, Professor Vladimir Voyakov, entitled From Mitogenetic Rays to Biophotons. In this account, they explain that Gurvitch looked for the evidence in order to support a theory he had formed, and how he found it. Lev and I were in touch and commenced a joint effort to preserve all of Gurvitch's writings and place them on the internet. He was extremely enthusiastic about this. Suddenly he died of a heart attack, but his efforts are being continued by his student and protege, Ilya Volodayev, with whom I now cooperate in this. We are making good progress in preserving the material that is in Russia. There was tremendous enthusiasm for Gurvitch's discoveries, and Gurvitch was nominated for the Nobel Prize in the 1920s and on numerous occasions over the years thereafter. Between 1923 and 1939, according to Belousov, more than 700 papers on the subject appeared, as well as books. Strange and somewhat embarrassing support came from one of Heinrich Himmler's SS researchers, Otto Rahn, R-A-H-N. Anyone interested in the bizarre career of Rahn can read about it on Wikipedia. But Wikipedia does not mention the important book by Rahn relating to biophotons, called Invisible Radiations of Organisms, published in Berlin in 1936, reprinted in 1944 after his death, which suggested that aging was due to the slowing and cessation of the emission of ultraviolet radiation within the body. A dubious idea. Ron also pointed out, however, that the healing of wounds took place because of UV emissions, and that irregularities of these emissions were implicated in cancer, which we now know to be true. Ron tried to leave the employ of Himmler and was apparently murdered in consequence in 1939. Many of his publications were cranky, and it is thus ironical that no attention has been called to the only one that was actually useful. But to return to Gurvitch, he wrote in Russian and in German, and very little of his work has ever been translated, but in the 1930s his work became accessible in Europe thanks to the appearance in German of one of his main books, written jointly with his wife and scientific collaborator Lydia Gurvitch, Die mitogenetische Strahlung, which means the mitogenetic rays, published in Berlin in 1932. But by 1939, the Second World War brought about such chaos that communications and academic exchanges were interrupted, especially with Germany. Gurvitch was awarded the Stalin Prize in 1941. But after the war, his work was forgotten thanks partly to the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the West. Furthermore, from 1942, Stalin's favorite and wholly dominant pseudoscientist, Trofim Lysenko, began to persecute Gurvitch, so that Gurvitch was not allowed to work in any laboratory and became a political pariah. Gurvitch's ideas thus dropped out of sight. My friend Joseph Needham, whose colleague I had the honor to be for some years from the mid-1980s, presciently supported Gurvitch's ideas in 1950. But this unfortunately had no significant effect on the widespread ignoring of the subject subsequent to 1939. Gurvitch also discovered that the emission of the ultraviolet photons must be coordinated by the whole organism, which he attributed to its morphogenetic field, in line with his pre-existing theories. He was extraordinarily prescient in this, because the work in physics had not yet been done to explain the mechanics of how such a field might work. It was only after his death that the concept of coherence, that's in the specialist sense, of waves having the same characteristics, such as phase and frequency, within a spatial area, as distinct from its better-known usage to describe superposition in quantum mechanics, emerged in physics as a result of a paper published by Robert Dicke, that's D-I-C-K-E, but they say Dicke, in America in 1954. This coherence only became a concept in biology many years later, which then made it possible to put some flesh on the bones of Gurvitch's field theory. It is not granted to us all to live long enough to see our theories justified, and Gurvitch did not have this good fortune. But in trying to figure out the mechanics of the process, Gurvitch was ahead of his time and became the first person to suggest the existence within organisms of what we now call collective states and cooperative phenomena, but which he called states of mutual alignment and orientation of molecules. He suggested that this was associated with a redistribution of energy within the organism in an organized fashion at the macroscopic scale, and that chain reactions of signal propagations took place. It was the spatial organization of the whole organism that was important, and it superseded the importance of individual atoms and molecules, demonstrating to him the existence of biological fields. All of these ideas now exist in far more sophisticated form, substantiated by a huge amount of experimental work. But mainstream biology and mainstream medicine show no knowledge or recognition at all of this progress, with one exception that I know of, a large grant by the Dutch government. There are no grants or funding anywhere in the Western world for biophoton research. Scientists cannot yet live on air, and until they invent a way to do so, they must either starve or abandon their biophoton work. And biophoton work takes laboratory time and needs assistance, and then the findings need journals willing to publish the results. So difficult was it to find journals willing to publish biophoton findings, even in the heyday of biophoton research, that the small but international biophoton research community had to adopt a different strategy to achieve publication and get around the roadblocks of the unwilling journals. They held numerous international biophoton conferences, gathered up the papers of the speakers, and published them in volumes of conference proceedings. And sometimes anthologies of papers were also published without an underlying conference as a source. The majority of the conferences were held in Germany and Russia, but the papers were published in English. So underfunded were these endeavors that many of the papers translated into English by their non-English-speaking authors have poor grammar and spelling, and strange phraseology and usages, replicating those of the native languages of the authors, because there was no money to pay for most of the volumes to be copy-edited or proofread. In quoting from some of these publications, I shall therefore correct their English, and therefore clarify their meaning. I shall do this in the rest of this book, simply for the sake of clarity. This defect of language is particularly true of one of the most interesting biophoton books of all, Current Development of Biophysics, published in 1996 by Hangzhou University Press in China. The book is very rare, but it contains some of the most important insights relating to biophotons ever published. It had three editors, two of whom I know. The third editor was Professor Fritz Albert Popp, whom I was never fortunate enough to meet because of his many years of debilitating illness before his death. The others were Marco Bischoff and Zhang Chengnin. I give his name in the Chinese form with the surname first. Both of them are absolutely delightful men of warmth, humor, and brilliance of mind. Marco is a great scholar of the history of these subjects, who has been tireless in writing and publishing on the subject such fundamental, incisive, and broad surveys that they shall remain classic accounts for ages to come. Leading international biophoton researchers who contributed to that volume were Popp, one of whose most important papers appears in it, Poland's leading researcher, Professor Barbara W. Kwirot, Gurwitz's grandson, Lev Belousov from Russia, Professor Roland von Weick, Professor Gushue Li of the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and Professor Michael Lipkind of Israel, whose paper was entitled Application of the Theory of the Biological Field of A. Gurwitz to the Problem of Consciousness. I have prepared a list of important books on biophotons in English, many of which are extremely difficult to find, but all of which are of great importance. I have listed them chronologically by the dates of their publication. A list of some important biophoton books in German that have never been translated into English is also included in it. These bibliographies are to be found on the dedicated website of this book. There are, in addition, numerous volumes not specifically devoted to biophotons, such as those concerning coherence in biological systems, which are nevertheless highly relevant and contain important material relating to biophotons. Some of these will be cited in the closing portion of this book, where physical coherence is stressed in a wider context. And of course, there is the book by von Weick of 2014, already referred to, as well as a sequel volume by him, which appeared in 2017. It is important to tell people where to find information about this suppressed subject, as it took me a long time to discover and obtain all of these books, and it is not easy to do so. I therefore hope that I have made it easier for others by at least listing them. The biophotons themselves are only part of a much larger picture, which took shape largely as a result of studying the biophotons. It was the brilliant Russian scientist Viktor Mikhailovich Inushin who pushed the boundary much further in his writings about bioplasma. This term bioplasma was coined in 1944 by the Russian scientist V.S. Grishenko. In 1967, Grishenko and Inushin were working together on bioplasma, and they announced then that they envisaged a plasmatic state within living organisms which, in contrast to inorganic plasma, would be a cold plasma possessing a high degree of order. This was an interesting idea, for the cold plasmas in space, such as the Kordalevsky clouds, for instance, are more likely to be intensively ordered and to show emergence and self-organization, and indeed, inorganic life. One would not normally think that the human body could contain a cold plasma, which seems counterintuitive, considering how warm the body is. But Grishenko and Inushin worked out that this is possible. And what is more extraordinary, as we will see in a moment, they believed that this cold plasma would chiefly be found in the brain. So to make it clear, bioplasma is the name they gave to that plasma which they were convinced joined with a physical body and helped it to operate, or even coordinated and guided its growth and development. This idea was essentially the same as Aristotle's pneuma, as discussed earlier. Just to remind you, Aristotle believed that ether existed beyond the Earth's atmosphere and was a fifth element, and that pneuma was a somewhat inferior form of ether that actually was found inside physical bodies and helped to animate them. Grishenko and Inushin, doubtless without realizing it, have duplicated Aristotle's reasoning and consider plasma to exist in space and bioplasma to exist inside our bodies, hence the bio prefix. And one of the manifestations of the bioplasma is the emission of the biophotons. This was a concept where for every organism's plasma body, biophotons would just be one manifestation. Very few Western scientists were ever allowed to meet Inushin, since he was considered by the former Soviet Union to be their most brilliant and important expert in the field of parapsychology, with its many military applications, such as remote viewing. His existence first became known to the outside world in the 1970s, and in 1977, a tantalizingly brief article by him of only 5.5 pages appeared in English translation in the compendium volume entitled Future Science. His contribution was called Bioplasma, the Fifth State of Matter? In this, he says, quote, "A living organism can be described as a biological field, or biofield. We have obtained evidence that a fifth state of matter, bioplasma, exists as a part of each organism's biofield. Bioplasma consists of ions, free electrons, and free protons. It is highly conductive and provides opportunities for the accumulation and transfer of energy within the organism, as well as among different organisms. Bioplasma appears to be concentrated in the brain and the spinal cord. At times, it may extend considerable distances from the organism, raising the possibility of telepathic and psychokinetic phenomena." Unquote. It was the latter aspect that so interested the military and security services of the Soviet Union in connection with what they called psychotronics, and they were careful to keep Inushin under wraps, whereas other less important scientists in this field, such as Viktor Adamenko, were allowed to mix with Western investigators. Inushin had known the Kirlians, a husband and wife team, who were the inventors of Kirlian photography, as they were his neighbors when he was young. As a boy, he had sometimes assisted them in their work. He thus built up a lifetime's background in investigating and experimenting with strange phenomena relating to living organisms of all kinds, including humans, especially psychic humans, of the type of the American Ingo Swann, but only those who were within the Soviet bloc, such as the famous Russian psychic Kulagina. The Soviets had some truly spectacular people of this kind, who were the best recorded cases of psychokinesis, which means the ability to move physical objects around by the power of the mind alone, without touching them. It was Inushin who provided the scientific theory to explain all of this, and that theory was a highly elaborate one that developed out of ideas of bioplasma. Very little of Inushin's work has ever been translated into English, except for secret translations that have never been released by the American security agencies. I have some privately translated writings of his, the earliest of which dates from 1969 and concerns acupuncture. These translations, in very poor English, were commissioned by my friend Marco Bischoff, and he kindly let me have copies. Inushin's work also related to biophotons, and as he wrote in his 1977 article, quote, "Our experiments with light indicate that bioplasma is especially conductive for photons in the ultraviolet range." Unquote. That is precisely what biophotons are, photons in the ultraviolet range. And he adds, quote, "Our group has hypothesized that an organism's bioplasma is an important factor in the emission of light from an organism from causes other than high temperatures." Unquote. Inushin's concept of a bioplasma body accompanying the physical body, which we might also call a dense matter body, we'll come back into the discussion in the next chapter. His bioplasma theory follows Gurvitch's suggestion that biomolecules in the organism are predominantly present in the excited state. I am again using the term excited state in a quantum physics sense to mean that a system or an electron has absorbed energy and entered a state of having higher energy than normal. This is called being excited. In Inushin's account, the energetics of living systems are based on excitation-de-excitation dynamics. Inushin describes bioplasma as a cold plasma of highly structured collective excitations produced by the polarization of biological semiconductors. In other words, the energies in bioplasma bodies are dynamic grids of excitations, which interact with fields outside the body. In 1967, at the same time that Grishenko and Inushin were announcing their bioplasma hypothesis, the Polish biologist Włodzimierz Sedlak, that's S-E-D-L-A-K, 1911-1993, independently came up with his own bioplasma hypothesis as well. He and Inushin later got together and worked on the idea jointly. This was facilitated because at that time, Poland was part of the Soviet bloc, so that their mutual cooperation was considered acceptable by the authorities. Inushin himself lived in Alma-Ata in Soviet Kazakhstan. Inushin also researched biophotons. According to the bioplasma studies of Inushin and Sedlak, the plasma particles constituting the bioplasma in the body set up highly structured waves of excitation that, as we have just seen, serve as an energy network. The energies stored in the network form an internal biological field. Remarkable as it may seem, this biological field has a complex broadband wave structure of great stability that stores holograms. In exploring the complexities of plasma in the body and its connections with consciousness and images in the brain, Inushin and Sedlak are here leaning on the work of Professor Carl H. Pribram, 1919-2015, who originated the holonomic brain theory, as he called it, to explain consciousness, using the idea of holographic memory. Most people today are familiar with holograms and are aware that the making of holograms, holography, has something to do with light rays, though they may be vague about how it all works. A hologram made by this method is a picture, in quotes, not of an actual image, but instead of a light wave interference pattern. When the pattern is activated, then the image appears in a three-dimensional mode. The internet is full of explanations of how this is done. However, what few people realize is that holograms can be made without the use of light rays. Carl Pribram explained this at length as long ago as 1971 in his technical book, Languages of the Brain. He believed that holographic processes operated within the human brain and were used in the storage and activation of memories in particular. Pribram said, quote, "Optical systems are not the only ones that can be subjected to the holographic process. Holograms are thus not dependent on the physical presence of waves. This independence of holography from physical wave production is an important consideration in approaching the problem of a neural holographic process." Unquote. Clearly, it would take too long to summarize here Pribram's theory of the brain as a hologram, about which many books have been written, not least by Pribram himself. But it is important to realize that enormous intelligences in the Kordalevsky clouds would probably have fantastically advanced holographic capabilities, which would be used not only to store their massive amounts of information, but also to generate images in any form, whether as waveforms, pure data, or optical images that could be seen by the eye, if there are any eyes in the clouds. Technically, none of this poses any problem. The clouds would readily be able to extract 3D images of the kind familiar to us and transmit them to our brains if they wished to do so. We could even make a pun and call this cloud holography, and the cloud in this case, of course, is not owned by Apple. Another Polish researcher, Adam Gregor Adamski, says that a lot of bioplasma is stored in melanin, which, as most people know, exists in the skin and protects us from ultraviolet radiation by causing us to get tan or brown. He says, quote, "Melanin is not only a semiconductor, but also a room temperature superconductor. Melanin accumulates in the cells of the nucleus, where the genetic material, DNA, is. In order to protect the genetic code from the damage from UV rays, these properties of melanin reveal that it has large resources of bioplasma. With the semiconductor properties of proteins and melanin, electrons can travel over long distances without losing energy. Bioplasma is understood as a dynamic system in an organic semiconductor. The total energy of the bioplasma consists of thermal motion, kinetic energy of particles, floating particles, the electric field, the magnetic field, and solitons." Unquote. We can see how, like so much else, these studies draw heavily upon the early pioneering work of Albert St. Georgi, who was the first person to insist that the body contained organic semiconductors, as I have already described. Just as the work of Alf Venn and his followers has revealed the complex living reality of outer space and the interactions there of plasma and electromagnetism, so his fellow Nobel laureate, St. Georgi, and his followers have revealed the immensely and astonishingly complex operations of electromagnetism and plasma within the human body, and outside it too. Returning briefly to the subject of biophotons, when they are seen being emitted from acupuncture points and meridian lines, they are not a sign of cancer at all, but rather an indication of the normal, heightened activity in those key regions of the body. Biophoton scans actually give clear visual images of the mysterious flowing body energy, doubtless a flowing plasma, known as qi in Chinese acupuncture. These streams inside the body, which have been detected frequently, are known as light piping, more technically described as channels of light emission. Such channels form a meridian network. This is one of the most important areas for research, since its findings clearly validate the Chinese system of acupuncture points and meridians in the body. The light pipes and the traditional acupuncture meridians are the same. As we build up a picture of the role of plasma within human bodies and consider the idea that plasma may provide a medium for interaction with universal fields, we see again that ancient wisdom anticipated cutting-edge discoveries in modern science. Chapter 16.